To all who shall see these presents, greetings. I'm Adam Best. This is Veterans in the Wild.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another show. This is episode 7. We have a special guest, a former Navy SEAL turned entrepreneur. He's ever revolutionizing the market on CBD. We are happy to have William Branham with us. Welcome, William.
Thank you, sir. I'm happy to be here.
Great. So we're going to dive right into hopefully a unique question. You had 26 years in the United States Navy, correct?
Correct.
What would you look back on and say was probably your favorite moment or your proudest moment?
I would say probably the coolest thing that I did is probably the most unsexy thing that I did, quite honestly. And that was, so in 2005, we were tasked with being a part of the security detail for the interim government of Iraq. Yes. And this was a no-fail mission and very unsexy and thankless. And but the cool part about that mission was I got to be in the room. I was the only American in the room. Actually, my OIC was also in the room. We switched off positions. When they were writing the Iraqi constitution, when they were writing that document, that historic document, I got to be in the room for it. I don't know what they were saying. I mean, I had a translator there and he would kind of, you know, fill me in on some stuff, but, you know, like I got to be part of history. You know, there's other things that are like cool, you know, doing missions that get approved by the president of the United States. Yes. Like regular SEAL team missions don't. There are some missions that do get, you know, go to that level because that for the strategic importance of what they're doing, what that mission is. So I, you know, got to do some of that, but really I think that the coolest was that, you know, being in the room, doing that extremely thankless job and getting to be a part of history.
So did they ask you to sign, I'm sure?
Yeah, I just went right up there and like put, you know, my signature right on the thing.
Now it's official. I've signed it.
Yeah, now we're good to go. Exactly.
You also mentioned that part of what you did was escorting or security for the elected officials in the Iraq government. Was that part of that time?
So it was the interim government. These were elected officials from the prime minister to the president to there were several vice presidents. And so we had to provide an entire SEAL platoon to each of those officials. So I think there were 8 or 9 different officials, and we had a whole task force that was in charge. And so the value of the government official is they got all of the U.S. State Department assets that went along with that. Well, they got a SEAL platoon to help keep them safe. They were able to get training for their Iraqi security personnel. They got armored vehicles. They got to use U.S. aircraft to get around the country. I have, you know, I didn't get one of the deals where there was a, you know, a platoon that was with one of the prime ministers, and they went to like Dubai and all sorts of places. They were staying in like 7-star hotels. You couldn't go into the lobby without a coat and jacket. You know, they said like the aquarium in the lobby was like, you know, rivaled SeaWorld. And so they were traveling around the world with their official. I was traveling around Iraq with mine. It was not as cool. There were some scary parts of it too, though.
Yes. But I'm sure they loved you too, as much value as we could add to them.
You know what? It depended on the officials. Some of them were like, Americans are bugging me. Maybe we're like too close to them. And when they're trying to be corrupt, or we're, you know, my guy didn't want me. He didn't want us. He was like, I do not want an American presence. And so when he said that, we went to a different part of Iraq, a different part of Baghdad, and we started doing, you know, the SEAL team mission. Yes. You know, we started kicking in doors. We got some, you know, some bad guys. We did some pretty cool stuff. And then, you know, the SEAL leadership, they talked to, you know, this VIP, and they're like, hey, you know, if you take the SEAL platoon, then you get all of these other assets. You don't get these assets if you don't take the SEAL platoon. And so he was like, okay, fine, I'll take the SEAL platoon. And so it was terrible news for us. So we got pulled right back in and had to go do that job. But yeah.
Got it. I've heard you talk before that you joined the Navy as a gunner's mate and asked the chief of naval operations to be a SEAL.
Fact.
Facts. Facts. He doesn't just wake up one morning and show up on a ship. So obviously you knew he was coming for a day or two, a week or two, probably.
Yes. So I guess, yeah, go ahead. Ask whatever.
Was that your decision to ask the highest ranking officer in the United States Navy to change your,
you know what? I didn't even know really like what that meant. The chief of naval operations. I was took a nobody in the Navy. I was clearly not getting my way in the Navy. And I was just trying to like do the best job I could every single day and try to get to buds because I wanted to be a SEAL.
Yes.
And, you know, roadblock, everyone's saying no. I mean, the people who matter are saying no. Everyone else is saying, yes, this is, yeah, yes, you should. Yep. And then, you know, we get word that the CNO is coming to our little ship in Yokosuka, Japan. And some guys that I worked with, they're like, you should ask the CNO, you should ask Admiral Borda if he'll let you go to buds. And I'm like, really? Okay, sure, I'll do that. Because he was a common sense leader in that, you know, when he was doing other jobs. So here's an example for you. So if you're overseas, if you're going to be stationed overseas, you have to get this overseas screening medical thing done. And if you're overseas and you take another overseas billet, like in the same country, the same area, you have to do another overseas screening. Why? You're already overseas. They're like, they're not going to not send you overseas. So it was just all of this, you know, nonsense. And then people would just ask him when he was in like these positions of authority and they're like, yeah, he's like, yeah, that makes sense. So he would just make changes like that, common sense changes, you know, throughout his career. And so then he was coming to my ship. Actually, he went to like the base theater first and answered a bunch of questions. And that went for like 3 hours. I just kind of sat in the back. I'm like, maybe I'm going to ask him. And I talked to my commanding officer beforehand and I talked to everyone. I'm like, hey, so people say that I should ask the CNO. And so it wasn't like I just woke up one day. I'm like, hey, most senior guy in the military. There was a little bit of planning, a lot of fear. And, but I'm like, what do I have to lose? Like, this is what I want to do. So just go do it. I mean, if he wasn't coming to my ship in front of like the entire base of, you know, Yokosuka, Japan, I would have gone up on stage and asked him if I could be a SEAL then. But I knew that he was coming to my ship and thankfully they like cut it off and like, he didn't go to any other ship. He just came to our ship and we did it. So.
Yep. Awesome. And then one other interesting perspective would be if you never met the CNO or you never asked the CNO to be a SEAL, do you think GM3 gets out of the Navy? Do you think he stays in the Navy?
No, I would have figured something else out. Write my congressman, write lots of letters to different congressmen, ask more people, you know, as long as you just keep asking. So, and, you know, kind of this whole like pivot to entrepreneurship that I'm on, you know, I don't know anything about sales. But what I have learned, you know, in my research and like, I'm not a salesman. You know what? Everyone is a salesman. We all sell something, whether we sell ourselves, we sell whatever. And there's a rule out there that you have to touch someone at least 9 times before they really pay attention, before they're really interested in buying your product. So going back to that, those experiences, I didn't know that. Like, you're going to have at least 9 failures before you're going to get a yes. You're going to get at least 9 no's before you get to yes. So just go. So now that mentality, I'm like, okay, check. So, but yeah, I would have just kept asking. I would have, you know, the next person, you know, who Admiral so-and-so, big guy so-and-so, I would have maybe gone to buds and be like, hey, could you guys let me come to buds somehow? I don't know. I would have figured it out.
Knock, knock, knock. I'm here.
Like failure was not an option.
Yes.
I mean, failure is always the option, but not completing the mission was not the option.
Got it. Perfect. Makes sense. Okay. So you become a SEAL. We know that's a long and arduous process, and you've discussed it a lot of different times. You also became a sniper for the SEALs. I wanted to talk more about that, if you would.
Yep.
What would you say was either different, more challenging, or more unique about being a sniper than earning your Trident?
I would argue that sniper school, at least when I went through, I now went back and I taught as an instructor. It was as hard as BUDS, just in a different way. You know, BUDS, you like wake up early, you do the grind. They, you know, try to make you quit. Then they try to make you better. And eventually you graduate. Well, sniper school, you're under the gun every single day. You have to perform from, you know, shooting to all the skills that go into being a sniper, from, you know, stalking, sneaking around out in the, you know, big open fields and like setting up FFPs, final firing positions. Camouflage and concealment, shooting on the range, shooting just the Navy qual. You know, you have to shoot expert on that, you know, every time. Yes. Doing these observation drills where you like have an hour to find 10 objects out in a field and they're very well hidden, where you're using like your spotting scopes and binos and you're drawing stuff and all of this field craft. It's hard to do. And you have to perform at a certain level. So when I went and I eventually graduated, I had a little trouble with stalking, and eventually the light came on, and I had a little trouble with field sketch. And I was like, I like to joke that I almost failed sniper school because I couldn't draw. And so our final, like our FTX, where it was very cool, where they don't do that this anymore, but we were able to go into downtown Indianapolis, like in the kind of hood and like a super abandoned area, housing area. And we took over a building. Like there was like six of us took over a building, and we did, you know, kind of a recon of the area for like 2 days. And then at like 3:30 in the morning on the third day, there's a target out there, and we get, you know, over the radio, hey, you know, you're cleared hot to take out the target. And so everything was coordinated with, you know, the Indianapolis Police Department and things like that, so that we didn't like accidentally shoot someone. But we did have like people like kind of like walking through the area at different times of the day. And so we had to like stay hidden. But that was like, you know, some cool piece of that. But yes. I had to, like, one of my tasks was to draw like perfectly, like vanishing points and all these like silly things that go into drawing and observation and things like that, and intel that I still have the clipboard from sniper school and that final drawing that I did of that target, and I have it laminated. And I'm like, dude, I almost failed sniper school because I couldn't draw. They don't have that strict, like, you have to be an artist to be a sniper anymore. But yeah.
Yeah, and that's kind of crazy. You don't really think, I guess until you really approach being a sniper, or I'm not that involved with hunting, but you don't really think about what all goes into being a sniper. It's not just
right, no, being not an at accurate all. Shot. And even when, like, you just think you're going to shoot stuff, it's so much more than that. You know, there's chems drills, which are keep in memory. And they'll put like 10 items on the table. You have 60 seconds to memorize every item on the table. Then in like, hold that in your memory for 30 minutes or an hour or whatever, and then go back and then write down accurately what all the items are. Or, you know, go for a walk in the, you know, around the building, and there'll be different military items, and you have to like memorize these items. And then when you get back, write them down. Or, you know, watch a film from, you know, a movie clip, and, you know, remember all the different things that happen in the film, then go to the range for the day, come back, okay, take out your and like write down, you know, whatever, like these different things. Yes. And so like that's hard. That's a very specific skill set that you have to practice. Range estimation, so you have the scope, there's mil dots in it, and you basically measure a known height of a target. And then you do this mathematical formula and figure out like how far away the target is, and then you can engage the target. So things like that. And, you know, I got through sniper school. I thought I was a pretty good sniper once I got to the platoon. But when I went back and I became an instructor at sniper school, I realized that I didn't really know the material as well as I thought I did.
Yes.
And I was like, I like doing this part, and so I'm going to ignore this part. But you know what happened the day, you know, when I went back and I was a student instructor, they were like, okay, William, you get this. You get to teach this class, this class, and this class. I'm like, I hate all three of those. I don't want to teach any of those. So guess what I had to do? I had to learn all three of those. So it was good that they challenged me. They were like, okay, they didn't ask me if it was my weakness or not. They just said, you're a sniper. You know how to do this. Go teach it. And I was like, okay, check. I got it. And so when I went through the process of actually learning the material in order to teach it, in order to give it to a bunch of A-type, argumentative, I know everything dudes, like, they will challenge you if they smell weakness. They will challenge you if you don't say the correct thing. They will challenge you if what you say is off from what you said just a minute ago.
Yes.
Because they're listening. They're paying attention. They're smart dudes.
Yep.
And so I had to, like, learn the material in such a way that so that 20 different guys could ask 20 different questions and I would have the answer for it. But I wanted to give the material. I wanted to give the information so clear and concise that they would not have any questions. And when I was able to, like, break it down into, like, that kind of simplicity, I didn't have a lot of questions when I was teaching those classes.
Awesome. Yeah. That's what everyone always says is the best way to really understand a subject is to teach it.
100%. It's crazy.
Yep.
I mean, it's hard. It's not like there's no easy way around that. And there's, like, ego and pride and all this other stuff that you just got to, like, get rid of and, like, buckle down and do the work.
Yep. One of the things I've always been impressed with, and I think, I hope, or maybe I don't know if this is true or not, but I feel like the Navy SEALs had a great approach to their planning process. So briefing a mission or, yeah, basically briefing before you go do an op. Could you talk a little about that? I think that became the standard for what the entire fleet or the entire military uses now. And is there any time that maybe that saved you guys or maybe found something before the mission started that really exposed a weakness, a threat?
Sure. So that's a really good question. There's six steps-ish. I have my own version. My version has six steps of kind of mission planning.
Yep.
And, you know, so you have the mission, you have, like, what the mission is, like the mission statement. And then you have the planning. The planning is, like, who's going to do what, how you're going to do it, routes to get there, whatever it is. And then you brief the plan. And when you brief the plan, you tell people you're going to do this. First of all, this is the mission so that there's no question. This is the mission. The mission is to go here and get this guy. We don't have any other missions other than that. There are contingencies that can happen that can impede or may shift our focus on this mission, but this is our mission. So go back to mission statement. And then you brief it and you do this, you're doing that, you're doing that. And generally, guys are briefing that back to you. I'm going to do this. And so that they have ownership, they have, you know, they have their purpose in the mission. And then the most important piece, which is the most, again, going back to, this is the most unsexy piece of the whole thing, is practicing the plan or doing a dirt dive. And you're not practicing, like, the actions on the objective. You're practicing the things that actually matter, the things that get screwed up no matter what, 100,000% of the time. And that's, like, these transition points. We screw up transitioning from the military all the time, but, you know, these critical points of transition. So we'll get into Humvees and we'll drive to a target. When you get out of the Humvees, there's a right way and a wrong way to do it. A coordinated way, you know, you get there and then you go and surround the target, or you go and you have guys climb buildings. So there's a transition. And then when everyone is set, then you do the actions on the objective. Maybe you have a gunfight during the process. Maybe not. You do the whole thing. Maybe nothing happens. Maybe it's a dry hole. Maybe there's nobody there. Maybe you need to transition to another target area to find the guy. Still, what's the mission? Do you have to get back in the vehicles, go to the another location, or maybe you walk? It depends how far away it is. There's all of these transitions. And now maybe you find the guy, you wrap him up, you're getting ready to leave. Now everyone is coming back to the vehicle. Now there's a big gunfight. Now there's an ambush. And your mission is not to assault that ambush. Your mission is to get that guy and get out. So you have to go back to this transition. You have to suppress the fire, figure out the best route out, get everyone back into the vehicles, and then get a good head count and leave. And these transitions are the things that you're really practicing. This is where life is lost. This is where time is lost in races. You know, triathletes, you know, they have these transition points where they're like ripping out of their wetsuit and they're putting their shoes on or getting on their bike. Like those transition points, those are the things that you have to practice the most. You have to practice the other stuff, like the gross motor movements. But those transition points, those are the micro movements. So those are the things that are actually the details that are going to be mission success or mission failure. You know, I have a buddy, Mike Dave. He was shot like 27 times or something like that. Ridiculous. And so the heavy gunfire, he was, you know, he went into a room and there were three dudes in there. They were set up and they just shot the shit out of him. And he played dead. And then like one guy walked up to him and shot him. And it like the bullet went in and it hit the top layer of his soft armor. So generally we don't wear the same body armor anymore, but thank the Lord Mike had that armor on, this old school armor. And it like hit this like Kevlar, the soft armor that we wore under our hard plates. It's 32 layers of Kevlar. And the guy shot him at his belly button, like kind of a security round. If the guy was smart, he would have shot Mike in the head and he really would have been dead, but he didn't. He shot him like at the bottom of his soft armor, and the bullet traveled up his entire body and it stopped right here at like level 31 of Kevlar.
Wow.
Before, like, instead of like coming out and like hitting, you know, killing Mike. But that task unit, they pulled off, like, they're like, oh, this is like a lot of, you know, dudes are in there. And they were going to call in close air support to drop the building, but they didn't have a head count. So they were like, this is like the end of their deployment. They didn't have a full head count. They didn't have a good transition period. Like those transition periods are where people die. And so, you know, Mike played dead, you know, the bad guys like left the room, Mike got up and he like, you know, eliminated those three guys. And with his pistol, like he's such a bad shot. I think he was shot in the hand too. He had to like reload to finish the job. And then he was like, he got on the radio and he was like, hey, where is everyone? Schwedler's dead. And like, I'm in here by myself and I just got the shit shot out of me. And so because they were like, they became complacent. They had been deployed for 6 months. They had done a bunch of missions.
Yes.
And now they're like, they had a guy that was wounded because there was a guy outside the window where Mike, of the room that Mike got shot. He got shot in the arm. That was his first day in Iraq. And so he left like, you know, the next day. First deployment, first platoon, first everything. And, but it was that transition. And so the transitions in your mission planning, those are the things that you need to practice. And those are the most important parts of the plan. And then the second most important part of the plan is the after action report. So you go and execute the mission and you come back and you talk about what went right and what went wrong. And then you incorporate those pieces into, you know, the next mission, the next plan, into training or what have you.
Awesome. That's a lot of things I hadn't thought about or really considered before, but that's very interesting perspective. I also heard you talk about operational deficiency reports. And I think this is something maybe for the team specifically, but I think that sort of led to one of your last duty assignments where you were doing sort of R&D. You were doing, can you talk about that?
Yeah. So an operational deficiency report, I think this is a great tool for corporations. It's a great tool for the military. It actually started at a command on the East Coast, a development group. And basically what it is it's a report, or it's a basically saying, hey, we can't do this mission because we don't have this equipment or this technology or this whatever, fill in the blank, this tactic, technique, or procedure. And so they would like document it, and it would go routed up to the, you know, senior level, senior people in the command. And then they would find people to either, they would either find funding to try and solve the problem, buy this piece of equipment that they didn't have. And just the, that documentation was critical. And so that eventually moved over to the headquarters out in at WARCOM and out in California. And it got disseminated down to all the SEAL teams. So now all the SEAL teams, when they have a shortage of equipment or a shortage of a capability or a TTP or whatever it is. So like when we went from like, you know, kicking doors to being guarding these Iraqi officials,
yes,
we didn't have the equipment to do that. We didn't have the training to do that. We didn't know how to do that. So we had to, you know, an ODR went up, and then we found funding from the State Department to, you know, buy the equipment, the clothing, the whatever, the vehicles, the training that we needed to go and execute that mission. So that was sort of, that's kind of an example of an ODR. But so my last command was here in Hawaii. It was at Naval Special Warfare Group 3. One of the missions, the primary mission that we do is undersea operations. And again, you know, the missions are approved by the President of the United States because of the sensitivity of the missions. And so there's some funding that comes along with that for if you don't have a certain kind of technology. But Group 3 had been putting in ODRs, and there was not, there's no funding for R&D in the SEAL teams at all. It doesn't exist. We don't have the authorities, like it's all law and all this other stuff.
Yes.
And so we have these ODRs, but no one has done anything about them. Like generally the acquisitions department is the last department that we really want to put manpower. And I had done that job before. So I was like, I'll go do that. And because I knew that it could open up doors for me when I got out.
Yes.
So, but I didn't really know what I was doing in that respect. So I went in, I just started figuring things out. And so what I was able to do, I took whatever our deficiency was, and then I would go to a trade show or something like that. And I would just talk to people. Hey, can you do something like this? Hey, do you have the ability to create a thermal beacon that has a 360 degree, you know, like lighthouse flash that works at this wavelength of light that you can't see with the naked eye or with even with night vision, and you can only see it with this kind of a sensor, and you can dive it down to 66 feet, and it has to run off this kind of and they're like, that's very specific what you're looking for, and that doesn't exist at all. And so I would find a couple of companies that could maybe do something like that. Yeah. And then I would, after I had them, and they would give me a quote for what it might cost. And then I would go find funding. I would go find, you know, people who had research and development dollars, who had the authorities to spend these research and development dollars. And then I would say, hey, can I get, you know, $1.5 million from your money, and, you know, $1.5 million from your money, and then maybe some of yours, and then work. And then also have different companies working on the same project to kind of build that competition in companies. And then at the end of the day, we end up with the best product for the technology. We were creating new technology from, you know, from nothing, from a piece of paper that says, hey, we need this capability.
I don't know why. 5 years in the Navy, I never considered, I guess I always just considered everything I did was paid for by the Navy. But when you were saying, like, you know, you found funding in the State Department, or you found all the other funding, I mean, I guess me driving a destroyer or an LPD was much different than Navy SEAL operations, but I never had that thought until today. I've been out for 10 years.
I mean, there's big programs that pay for,
yes,
you know, ships and things, and even that pays for stuff that we have, but someone has to drive the train. Like there's a requirement that is written, like a giant requirements document, to build a new ship, to build a new whatever, however the, you know, the beds work on the ship. Like there's requirement documents that define exactly what it has to do. And that's, yes, what the builders have to use to create, you know, a new ship, a new, yep, aircraft, or a submarine, whatever it is. So it has to meet the requirements, and it's a pass or fail. And if it doesn't pass, then it, you know, it gets, you know, a couple tens of millions of dollars. That, oh, we're just going to like, sorry, it didn't work. It didn't meet the requirement. So that's, it's like a real, it's a weird world out there.
Yeah.
That's why there's so much money that goes into it.
True. Do you think that, that experience there, the second time there, sort of led you to consider creating your own business, or how do we go from Senior Chief Branham to Naked Warrior Recovery?
So that was an interesting transition. I planned on, and I started my own consulting company to sort of help companies navigate this military acquisition system. But what I kept running into, and I didn't know the right things back then, is people just wanted me to sell their widget. I'm like, I don't want to sell your widget. I don't believe in your widget. I can't sell like that. I can help you make your widget better. Oh, and by the way, they didn't want to pay me either. They only wanted to pay me for things that I sold. I'm like, I don't work for free. So first of all, my income went from like, you know, okay income to next to nothing. And then now people want me to like work for free. They want me to do, I'm like, it doesn't work like that.
Yes.
And so I, you know, got super frustrated, and I had a bunch of drinking issues and things like that. I had a bunch of noise up here from, you know, 26 years of service, toxic relationships, things like that. And I had heard about CBD, but, you know, being in the military, I wasn't going to try it. It wasn't like frowned upon. It just wasn't, you know, an option, you know, back then. And then I tried CBD, and I generally say that I didn't really notice a whole lot right in the beginning, but what I noticed over about 30 days is I noticed like water boils at 212 degrees. I was living at like 210 degrees. And after about 30 days, I was like, maybe like 205, 200, 190, maybe like 180, 180 degrees ish. And so it just took longer for that fuse to hit to that boiling point. And so, and also I have a lot of pains and I'm pretty broken. Yes. Like the pains that are just sharp and stabbing me all the time were just less sharp and less stabby. So I'm like, oh, that's good. Amazing. And then I stopped taking CBD, and like, you know, I started getting closer to that boiling point, and you know, some the pains, the sharpness started coming back. So I tried a different brand, and I'm like, I'm very interested in the world of CBD right now, but I want to like work for a company. And I went to a business conference that a friend of mine was a keynote speaker at. And I met a girl that was in the CBD industry, and she's like, why don't you just start your own business? She's like, do you want to do B, A to B, B to B, B to C? I'm like, I don't know what any of those words or letters mean, but can we talk about CBD? The A to B, I want CBD.
A lot of alphabet.
So I'm like, I don't know, CBD, man. And so she was like, just start your own company. And I'm like, I don't know how to do that. And so I just went and figured it out. But she educated me on the industry. When I found, you know, kind of dug into it, I found out the industry is like super dirty. The FDA has done lots of spot checks, and they found that most CBD companies out there don't have CBD in them. They have high levels of THC in them. I think most of those companies have gone away with the high levels of THC. They have high levels of heavy metals, mercury, arsenic, lead, things like that.
Wow.
There's, you know, because hemp is a bioaccumulator. So it pulls all the good stuff out of the soil. It also pulls all the bad stuff out of the soil. They're using hemp at Chernobyl to clean the radiation out of the soil. It's very powerful. So you need to have a good quality dirt to grow your plants in. And most people weren't doing that, or and still aren't doing that.
Yes.
So what I did is I went out and I found the highest quality suppliers that I could find. And I still look today and I have not found anyone with a higher quality supply chain than my current suppliers. And so I, you know, created a partnership with them, and you know, now we provide the highest quality CBD product out there. There's some other good, really good companies out there, but we are definitely top tier as far as quality goes. But you know, as I'm figuring out how to start a CBD company and how I came from like the SEAL teams to being an entrepreneur now, and all the pitfalls and roadblocks that I've had along the way. You know, I figured out that, you know, one of my limiting factors is my ego, and my ego gets in my way and I trip on that thing all the time. There's two kinds of ego out there. There's a good ego and there's bad ego. And I was using the bad ego. And the good ego is like, I'm going to go crush this. And, you know, I've got the support system and let's go get it. The bad ego is like, woe is me. Like, I don't want to like, whatever, you're wrong, I'm right. Bad ego. So what I ended up doing is I figured out like, I'm wearing this ego around like it's armor, like I'm being attacked. And there are some toxic relationships in my life and I still deal with them today, but I'm much more equipped and prepared to handle these, you know, these scenarios. So, and some of that was, you know, really the get naked mindset and, you know, taking my ego off so that I was able to heal. Like I was, you know, really hammered on for a super long time, most of my life on, you know, you're nothing, you're not smart, or that was my ego, or other people saying you're a failure, you're never going to make it, you whatever. And I'm like, no way, I got it. Like once I like changed my own mindset and was like, I got this, then I got this. I started moving forward. And so what the naked warrior is, we're all naked warriors. We can all get naked and is, you know, it's taking that armor off, taking that ego off and setting it in the corner and so that you can find the healing that you need. And then when you need to put that armor on, you put it on, you go into combat, just like in the SEAL teams, you go into combat, you do the mission, you come back, and then you can take that ego off. You put it on, you put the armor on when you need it. And the rest of the time, it stays in the closet, it stays in the corner. So, you know, get naked mindset is about, it's about never quit. And I don't mean never quit smoking or drinking or toxic relationships or porn or drugs or anything like that. What I mean is if you're going to do something, if you're going to start a business, if you're going to get a degree, if you're going to take a class, if you're going to, you know, be in a relationship, it's all of those things are hard. Those, they all take work. And sometimes you're going to feel like quitting, but don't quit. What you do is you, and it seems unattainable. You know, people talk about buds, like, how do you do that? That's like, I couldn't do that. You, of course you could. And I remember specifically thinking when I graduated Hell Week, I was like, this wasn't that bad. Anyone can do this. You just have to want to do it. And so you just chop those things up that are just seem unattainable. You chop them up into bite-sized pieces or snack-sized pieces, and then complete that piece every single day. It doesn't matter how small it is, just complete that task every single day. So you never quit all the way until that task is done. And then you start another task or another project or another business or whatever it is. So you just, you chop it up into manageable pieces and you accomplish that task every single day. You're not doing the whole thing every day. You're doing that piece of it. So, you know, people talk about Rome wasn't built in a day. You eat an elephant one bite at a time. It's, you chop it up into, you know, bite-sized pieces that are easy to do. The A for naked is to accept failure. And, you know, failure is inevitable. Failure is the biggest lesson I've ever learned. The biggest lessons I've ever learned has been through failure. And so, you know, and some of the most successful people in our lifetime and outside of our lifetime have, you know, created a foundation of failure before they were successful. You know, Steve Jobs and Elon Musk were both fired from companies that they started. Then they became, you know, these icons of the world. Michael Jordan has missed more than 3,000 shots in his career in basketball, arguably the best basketball player of all time. I've failed more times than I can count. But what you do is you create these foundation of failure, and it ends up being these stairs, and it helps you hop over that, whatever that thing that is in front of you and that you keep failing at. And so you're able to like just go right over the obstacle and then get ready for the next obstacle. The K is kill mediocrity. We're surrounded by mediocrity every day. We got Netflix, we got instant gratification, we got YouTube, we got like social media. We can get sucked into all of that stuff and not really improve ourselves when we really should just be improving ourselves every single day. So the K is kill mediocrity. And sometimes that's like, put your phone down and actually look, or read a book instead of scroll social media, read a book instead of watching YouTube, or maybe watch YouTube, don't watch funny kittens, you know, watch something on there that's instructional on how to start a podcast or start a YouTube page or something like that. Start a company. So use technology and kill mediocrity. The E is expose your fears, and fears is the thing that holds all of us back. Not one of us is immune to fear. Mark Twain said that courage is the mastery of fear, not the absence of fear. Yep. So, I've certainly seen that in combat, but we always have these fears that are like in the back of our mind and they kind of control us. And when we're able to and we don't want to admit that we have these fears. We don't want to admit that this is bothering us, and it doesn't matter what it is. But what you have to do is you have to take that fear, you pull it from the back of your mind and you bring it to the front. And if you take a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper, not a keyboard, and you write the fear down, because a friend of mine says fear does not exist on paper. And when you take that fear that's bugging you and you write it down on paper, now you've exposed it. You've exposed it to light. Maybe you share it with someone. Now it's even more exposed. Now you control the fear. No one else controls that. That fear does not control you anymore. So expose your fear so you can control it. And the D is do the work, because it all requires work. You know, we're in a world of instant gratification with social media and YouTube and what have you. And we forget how to do the work. And oftentimes the joy in doing something isn't like the end result. The joy is like the process to get there. So, you know, sometimes just like getting prepared for a podcast, I'm not generally a talkative person, but I enjoy the process of like, what questions might be asked of me? What is the message that I want to share? And even if I've done 100 podcasts with a similar message, I still have to go back and I review my notes all the time. And just to get better and think of a different aspect of this question, how can I bring value in a different way? But it all requires work. But I like the process of getting there and the mental sort of gymnastics of challenging myself or being challenged by someone else. I love that. And so that's, you know, part of doing the work. And so at the end of the day, you know, if we can all take our ego off and set it in the corner and get naked and get it, you know, and then change our mindset on never quit, accept failure, kill mediocrity, expose your fears and do the work, the world will be a better place.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One thing I think is important to all veterans, and I think I've heard you talk before, is the statistic that there's veteran suicide is a very real reality for all of us. It's typically referred to as 22 a day, 22 veterans a day kill themselves. I've heard you say that the numbers actually may have increased recently. Studies
The VA's numbers as of November of 2020, they say that the number is 26 a day now.
Wow.
I've only seen one statistic that says that, but yeah, you could say COVID and lockdown and all that other stuff.
Sure.
But yeah, whatever. It's two a day is still too many.
Yes. And I was sort of leading you in there to talk also about, you have an event coming up, I believe in August, the SEAL Swim. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
There is an event coming up. It's, sponsoring the GI Go Fund. So the GI Go Fund is an organization that helps veterans, first responders, and other people of service. They help them, you know, with that transition from, you know, active duty to finding a new skill. There's a tremendous amount of homeless veterans on the East Coast. They help find housing for these veterans. They help train them up to find a new skill and help them find new jobs. And so this swim that we're doing, this will be the third year in a row. I did it last year. I wasn't able to do it the first year, but it's a swim across the Hudson River. So we do about a 2-mile run in New Jersey from one park to the next. Then we hop in the water and we swim out to a barge in front of the Statue of Liberty, where we do 22 pull-ups for that 22-0 number and 100 push-ups. So we've lost more veterans to suicide than we have in 20 years of sustained combat, which is absolutely unbelievable. And so we're bringing awareness to that. to that number. Like, I don't even know what the suicide rate for first responders is, but in today's political climate, I'm confident it probably blows away the veteran number. But no one talks about that because there's not the support system really to track those numbers, because everything is like, you know, city specific and things like that. But we're bringing awareness to this number of people who take their own lives senselessly. And then we swim over to Ellis Island. We do more push-ups and pull-ups, and we swim to the 9/11 Memorial. And this is, the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And then we do more pull-ups and push-ups there. And there is a link at GIGO.com, where you can go and you can, you know, donate money to support that event. Awesome. And
and that's coming up. That's on September 11th. Or it's
August. No, it's August 7th, I think.
Okay.
Like, if the things don't work out on August 7th, which is a Saturday, then we'll do it on Sunday.
Yeah, makes sense.
And I think there's like over 150 people signed up to do the swim right now. They're estimating that there'll be about 250 people. Now, that's a lot of people in the water. That's a lot of people in the water.
Yep. Yeah, and some in the Hudson Rivers too. It's a very interesting proposal.
When I did it last year, it wasn't that bad. Like, I've been in way dirtier water in my career. So I was like, whatever, dude.
Yeah.
I'm not going to drink the water, but yeah.
True. Well, I've really enjoyed this show. Could you tell our listeners where they may find you, or where they connect with Naked Warrior?
Yeah. So if you go to my website, www, I was told, someone else told me if I say www, then I sound old. But I like saying it just because now, www.nw/ horizontal,
yep.
recovery.com, nw-recovery.com, or you can go to nakedwarriorrecovery.com. I made it nw-recovery because maybe people don't want to write naked into the search engine. I don't know. But if you write nakedwarriorrecovery.com, it will take you to my website.
Okay. Awesome.
And then you can also follow me on Instagram at Naked Warrior Recovery.
Okay. Well, thank you again. I really enjoyed our show. And we look forward to all your future success.
Thank you, sir. It was awesome talking to you.
Thanks,
William. Talk to you soon. All right.